From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Kurt Johnson and his daughter Ellie Johnson, who have collaborated on a new novel titled The Barrens, a novel of love and death in the Canadian Arctic, published by Arcade. Kurt Johnson grew up in Minneapolis and spent summers on a remote island near the Boundary Waters canoe area, first with his parents, later with his wife, and then daughter, Ellie. Both Kurt and Ellie are graduates of the University of Minnesota, though, as you'll hear, Ellie also spent over 2 years in Burlington, Vermont, attending UVM. Ellie Johnson paddled the 450-mile Thelon River with three other women at the age of 17. The novel is based in part on that canoe trip, as well as her real-life experiences growing up as a gay woman. Ellie is a recent graduate of the University of Minnesota and lives in St. Paul. Both Kurt and Ellie live in the Twin Cities. Here's a little information about the new novel, The Barrens. Two young women attending college decide to have a summer adventure canoeing the rapids-strewn Thelon River that runs 450 miles through the uninhabited barren lands of subarctic Canada. Holly made the trip once before with a group of skilled paddlers she trained with at camp, and she wants to share that experience with her friend and lover, Lee, believing it will draw them closer. But a week in, Holly, the risk-taker, falls while taking a selfie near the edge of a cliff. She is left injured and comatose and soon dies. Their locator beacon for summoning rescue was smashed in Holly's fall. It remains to Lee, the inexperienced paddler, to continue the grueling and dangerous trip alone to save herself and return her lover's body to civilization and Holly's family. Kurt Johnson wrote The Barrens with his daughter's help as a consultant and editorial advisor. I spoke with Kurt and Ellie last week. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Why do you think readers love stories of adventure and danger, which this certainly seemed to be that?
Ellie, I'll let you take that one.
Well, I feel like at our core, we all kind of want to explore and experience something that we ourselves would not actually want to experience firsthand. I think it's like part of the fascination with horror movies as well. It's like we want these feelings of excitement, anxiety, something that feels close to the sensation, but maybe not actually, like, you're not actually in danger. You're maybe not actually even camping. You don't have to deal with the bugs. I think a lot of people are really challenged by going out into nature in particular and not having access to certain things that they do here in society. But they like the idea of that level of, I want to say just like inability to reach you. Like they want to be that far away from people, but they also don't want to be that far away from people. They want to be in danger, but they don't want to be in danger. I think it's all this sensation of what if I did feel like that?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I think that's really true. I ask that question to people a lot, and I think that may be the closest I've come to feeling like the answer really hit on it. You know, I mean, it's like we want to feel in danger. We do not want to be in danger. So now I know, Ellie, you went on a trip like this, a very big rafting, whitewater rafting, camping, hiking.
Yeah, same river, same route.
Yeah. So yeah. So that happened. Do you want to tell the story of how the book came to be?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my dad's story in a lot of ways. I mean, I went to a camp growing up called Camp Widgiewagon, which is in northern Minnesota. And I just started doing progressively longer and more technical canoeing trips. And that culminated in a 500-mile trek in the Canadian Arctic along the Thelon with three other women. Wow. When I was 17, I turned 18 on trail. And when I came back, my dad was the only one who was really interested in my stories. And I mean, they intrigued you enough that you bothered me to start writing a story.
Right, right. And then she went back to Burlington to go back to school.
Right. So and, did you go to UVM?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. I saw that in your bio and I was like, wait a minute. No one ever mentioned this.
Yeah, I graduated from the University of Minnesota, but I went to Burlington for about 2.5 years.
Oh, okay, great.
I loved it, yeah.
That's where I am right now, so.
You know, if you're in Vermont, there's like a 50-50 shot you're in Burlington. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So Kurt, your side.
So, yeah, yeah, she went back to Burlington and she was taking an English course or some kind of writing course or something. And I gave her this idea for a short story, which is two women go off on this trip. One dies and the other one has to canoe out with her body. So she just kind of said, well, I don't want to write that, but why don't you go ahead and write that? And I did. And it kind of started off as a short story, maybe more of a novella that I didn't have any aspirations in really publishing, just kind of do it for fun. And so it evolved from there. And I had to ask all these questions about the Thelon because I did some third party research, but I'd never been there. So I really relied on Ellie for all that information. And then, you know, it's about two lesbian women and I'm a straight older white guy. So and a parent who doesn't like to ask these questions, but I did. And so I asked Ellie the questions about, you know, growing up, coming out, understanding when she was gay, what were those first relationships like, and, you know, getting into a lot of the talks about sex, which, again, as a parent, I really didn't want to have. But we had those discussions because I wanted these, you know, you want your characters to be honest. You want them to be three-dimensional, and they have to have a backstory. And so it just kind of evolved into there. Now, everything's fictionalized, but a lot of the stories about Lee growing up in Nebraska or about Holly in St. Paul are based on our discussions, you know, at a bar over a couple beers or over the phone, or I had a couple nice conversations with Ellie and her partner, Kate. And it ended up being kind of fun. It was nervous, uncomfortable, but I think they enjoyed it as well, probably more than I did, frankly.
I mean, there's a certain level of having to just broach these topics with just a level of openness and honesty and know that, like, if you take me at my word for openness and honesty, like, that's how you're able to, you know, I don't know, being self-reflective in a way and having to almost translate your experiences for another person and also translate them back to yourself will kind of help you discover, I don't know, how, like, we become people as much as, like, in a book, how do you become a character? How do you become, like, a fully fleshed out person whose journey and self-discovery and everything feels authentic?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, wonderful. I do have some questions about some of the stuff you mentioned. I'm going to get to those in a little bit. I wanted to ask about narrative time. And I don't know, Ellie, how much you were involved in the writing of the book. Did you have editorial tasks?
To some degree, but it was more like a general story and fact checking and kind of making sure that the story felt authentic to the environment, to the characters.
Okay.
All that. So, but as a writer, that was all him.
Okay. Right. Well, you jump in and answer sure. things that are relevant to what you did as a consultant on the project.
Yeah, no problem.
But well, I wanted to ask about narrative time. You start chapter one 12 days into Lee and Holly's trip, and then chapter two, you kind of go to 2 weeks earlier. 12 days in is when something very big happens that we already know from reading the cover of the book. Then chapter two goes back 2 weeks, and it gives us a whole lot of time with Lee and Holly early in the trip. And I thought that was a really interesting... A nice way to kind of round out what Lee is going through. So I wonder if you can just talk about knowing when to start and when to back up and how much to move around.
Right. It's kind of an interesting story because it did start off. I started it off as first person present tense. So I kind of wanted to be in the moment. And I wanted to be kind of this quiet in the moment book about traveling through. Of course, there's a death and a, you know, an adventure story, but I wanted to be in the moment, and it was supposed to be more of a quieter book. And I did write that book, but then, you know, you go through process of editing and you get an agent and they have an opinion and,
damn it.
I don't know. Nobody likes, I don't think authors like to admit that. And I think it's a good creative process, frankly, because I think sometimes authors get into their third and fourth books, and I don't think they get any pushback at all from their editor or agent. And sometimes they start creating, you know, not very good books. At any rate, so I really needed to punch it up and make it a little bit more exciting. So I took the, you know, the incident of the initial fall, and put it up front just to create, you know, a grabber and a little bit of excitement. But so when I did that, of course, then I had to change everything from first person or from present tense to past tense. And then I had to rebuild those characters up to the moment when the inciting incident, the fall happened. So that's the story behind the narrative structure, but it really is overall pretty linear. You know, they get on the river, something happens, and they come off the river. It is interesting, all the backstories that Lee tells kind of around the campfire to herself, they're kind of verbal stories. They bounce around in time depending on her headspace at the time.
Right.
And don't ask me how and why they're in that particular order, but it felt right to me. And that's just about it. It was just an intuitive way of putting those stories together in the order that they were.
I thought, I'm going to ask you about the stories. I thought the stories were really smart because a lot of this is a very solitary novel. It's a single person out in nature. And I thought that right. Having those stories that Holly has told her, stories that she tells to Holly, even after Holly's gone, she sort of shares her life with her. Those were wonderful ways of bringing in scene and making it a little less of a solitary one person story, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. And I'd never, you know, I had this problem of a woman by herself on the river with nobody to talk to, and I had to create some kind of dialogue. So I thought, I'd never seen it before, you know, somebody do all their backstory with these verbal, you know, around the campfire type stories. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. And it added another dimension other than maybe these, you know, dream or, you know, other kind of backstory techniques I could have used, I guess.
Yeah. One thing about sharing the scene right up front about Holly's death, and I know you did that maybe for sort of like a little bit excitement in the book, but, you know, it made me think. And then later there's a story of these three men. Edgar and two other men, Holly tells this story about three men who died in the Barrens. And right away at the very beginning of her story, she says, you know, they went into the Barrens where all three eventually met their death. And I thought, well, there's another story where the ending is shared up front. And I thought it makes the tension different to have the ending up front. It changes what we are expecting from an ending to put the ending up front like that. And I thought that was interesting. It made the story of Lee on the river about something so much more than just, will they get out alive, the two of them, you know? It was very...
Right.
I find it interesting that you bring that up because that story was like really meaningful to like me and the other people who were on my trip with us when we were crossing through that area. The cabin actually, you know, is in an area called the Oasis along the Phelan, which is one of the only areas that has like growth, trees, stuff like that. And right before we entered, we were all sitting and having dinner one night, and my counselor brings out the diary of I can't remember the boy's name who wrote it right now, but he. Like, you know, up front that these guys, they starved at this point, like about 2 miles down the river from where we're camped. And it's not a very long diary, and it's not the book about the diary. It's just the diary. And we sat and read that over like dinner and tea that night. And it was just harrowing and sad and just to see this kind of like descent from the top. But yeah, exactly what you were talking about, knowing this ending going into this story, it kind of just changes the tone. And like even the adventures and the hunting, it just, it all takes on like this different weight to it.
Right.
Reading that story, like in the area it took place. I mean, that, like, I remember we talked about that quite a bit, like visiting the cabin, that story itself and the nature of like starvation and survival and like starving to death in an area like the Barrens.
And being the last one. I mean, how horrible.
Right.
How very difficult. Let's see. Do you mind if I just read a scene, a paragraph from the book? It's kind of an important paragraph.
So. Absolutely.
Sure.
Right, this is from right up front. Okay, the portage took us inland, away from the river, to the highest point of a bluff that stretched in every direction atop what seemed to be miles of sandstone shelf. I'm going to skip a little bit. Holly is leading. Holly pulled out her iPhone to take a photo. She had me stand with my back to the edge of the cliff, the canoe paddle held across my waist like a hunting rifle. She told me to push my hair away from my face, lift my chin, and smile. And then she takes Lee's picture, right? And then a minute later, she sets herself up for a selfie in that exact same spot. And that's when she falls. The sandstone gives way. It's not quite as much of a huge mistake as when you hear of people who accidentally, like, stumble backwards, you know, actually step back off of a cliff. The sandstone gives way. It was very interesting to have that suspense created by the fact that Lee stood there first, although it's early enough in the novel that I kind of went back and read it a few times because I was like, oh my God, that could have been her. So that was suspense. I also wanted to just ask you about when Holly does fall. There's a very choreographed section about what happens to her. She falls down this cliff. She goes into the water. There are rocks. Lee runs down and is running along the river trying to get to her, to help her, and eventually does get her out alive at that point. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about when to choreograph an active scene very tightly and when to let it be more general, and if you have thoughts on
that. Yeah, well, I do, because, you know, you go through a first draft and your writing's sloppy. You know, it just is sloppy. And you maybe get some eyes on it and you realize that it's not that exciting for them or they don't get it. And it, you know, it's because it is generalized. And when I have to dig deeper and I have to understand what is exactly happening to the body at every step of the way. And I have to detail that out so I know exactly what's happening. And that first draft, I don't have that. And then in the second and third and the fourth draft, I start narrowing it down. So I start, you know, really picturing, okay, did the body move this way through the river? And then it hit an eddy. And then what happened when it hit an eddy? And then it came out. What's going to happen? Where's the position of the legs in respect to the life vest that's holding up her torso? And I found that just that level of detail enriched it so much and made it that much more exciting. And it was just as simple as that. You get to that next level of detail and it brings it to life.
It feels like it slows down the pacing. It almost is like when you bring it down to these minute details, it feels like it recreates these emergency scenarios. You know, it's like you get into a car accident and everything kind of slows down and you become aware of every pop, crack and creak in those, like the span of a single second. I feel like it does a good job of stretching out those seconds of experience and adrenaline.
That makes so much sense. And it's very intense. It's very intense, that scene. And, you know, she's thinking, you know, and first of all, it's like to have that presence of mind. She's thinking about, where do I have to go? Where is she going to come out?
Sure.
You know, rather than just diving in and trying to chase her and down the river, which wouldn't have worked. I'm just curious if you were calling Ellie all the time at this point to say, like, what would happen in this eddy? And where did, you know,
We talked a lot about Whitewater.
Yeah, we talked a lot about Whitewater and eddies and holes and all that kind of stuff. So she gave me the tools.
Yeah. OK. Okay, great.
We also had to, in my training in Whitewater, you have to do a lot of training about like emergency scenarios. And in order to like go through what you're supposed to do and why, you go through like what would happen if you didn't do that. And so a lot of my conversations with my dad about like, you know, kind of this, like what would happen if like everything went wrong on one of your trips? And I'm like, well, let's start from the top. You would have had to only take like one emergency signal because you really want to make sure you bring two, because if one breaks and you're screwed, you know, and that's exactly what happens. Right. And then you work backwards, like, okay, what if someone gets hurt? Like, what if it starts to be like a difficulty to like move them, and what would happen then? And it's like, okay, you dump, what would happen? What happens if you can't get your feet in front of you and you're going down the water? Like, you start to just backtrack on all these like things that can go wrong.
Right. Yeah. That's, I just think it's cool that you guys worked together on this and were able to kind of like, you know, collaborate that way. Let's talk for a minute about setting. I mean, obviously this is absolutely beautiful nature setting. And yet you have scenes like at, I think it's the guy who sells them the canoe, who has a home that has a stainless steel chimney and barbed wire and chain link fence and a snowmobile and a half snowmobile and piles of scrap wood and all this stuff. And to me, that's super important to have the setting really reflect the real people that live in a place. You know, Vermont is always depicted as just like maple syrup and tendrils of smoke. You know, you go up in the Northeast Kingdom and there's real there's real people living up there, and they're living very real lives. Anyway, I appreciated that. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about your approach to setting. And also, were you looking at Ellie's pictures from the trip, or were you just kind of riffing on this stuff?
Well, I did look at a lot of the pictures from her trip, but of course, most of the pictures are of the trip itself and not of, you know, the city she went through when she came to the Barrens and left the Barrens. But, you know, like northern Vermont, northern Minnesota is the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot to pick and choose from in northern Minnesota to get those scenes right. And I'll be honest, you know, Google's phenomenal. So you go into Google and you can walk down the streets of some of these towns. And that's what I did. So I, you know, some of it's made up, obviously, and fictionalized, but a lot of it, I just walked down the streets with Google, yeah. You know.
We did talk quite a bit about like how it felt to be in these places, in particular, like Yellowstone and like Baker Lake. And there were a lot of pictures along the river. It's like when you do see an example of a person who is there, like a trapper, an old trapper cabin, because they'll move all this stuff in. And then by the time they leave, they don't want to take any of it with them. They want to take the pelts that they got while they were there over the winter. And so there's just these kind of like random standing structures and Baker Lake and Yellowstone too. It feels like in an area like the Arctic, all these structures just represent kind of survival. Mm-hmm. Like it's a warm house and it keeps the things that want to get your food and get in your home away. That's kind of what all these things look like.
Well, and Baker Lake was interesting because there's Ellie described all this graffiti that was there. And so you get the feeling of, you know, it's beautiful. They're in the tundra. Of course, it's summer, not winter. But you also get this feeling of isolation and people that want to get out but can't get out. And so I don't, you know, I put that in there. I love all that description of the desperation of most of these kids that want to get out of there. I don't know what it means, to be honest with you, but it was fascinating. And I think it was an element to the description that I wouldn't have had without Ellie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Baker Lake as a town, it doesn't have roads that you can drive into. So the town itself, you can only leave by plane or a shipping boat. And so even to like ship food in, the costs are exorbitant. So like a lot of the communities there are like still living on, you know, hunter-gatherer type subsistence to just like, you know, keep a calorie count, you know, especially through the winter months when, you know, it's a lot harder. You know, the caribou migration didn't just come through. And when we were there, the caribou migration had just come through. So there was, you know, like hunting just everywhere, like, you know, racks and corpses hung up everywhere. It was like really interesting to see just kind of how like culturally you you couldn't afford to like just buy groceries every day and eat. That would just not work in those communities. It just doesn't. So you still have to rely on these hunter strategies to get through, but you can't like easily afford like a plane ticket out, you know, casually if it's not for work. So a lot of these kids who are like born and raised in this community, there's like not a lot of chances to even like take a drive out to the town, the, you know, next mile up, because it doesn't exist. And so they just go to the abandoned campground that we stayed and write graffiti on the walls.
Yeah. Okay, great. So here's a question. Lee's father is Jake the Snake. And
Jake the Snake.
A lot of her stories concern her background. He is, he's an interesting character, a very interesting character. And in the end, I didn't feel that he had entirely served her poorly, although he's definitely not the easiest person to have for a father. But what an interesting choice for a father-daughter writing a book together to have this kind of like weird dad in it. So where did that come from?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, you don't growing up in Minneapolis and going to high school is just not that exciting, you know? So you want to almost give your character a certain amount of superhuman strength or background, you know, make her interesting and different. And you know, I also had to prepare this character for the journey that she was going to go on. So she was just growing up in Minneapolis and playing soccer. She's not going to throw a 120-pound body across her shoulder and walk out or survive for that matter. So I had to create a character that had some survival skills. Yeah. And it turns out that my mother's from near Columbus in a place called Schuyler, and Ellie and I and Stephanie, my wife, would go down there for Easter. And we met this one guy that lived in Columbus, and he was eco-anarchist and lived off the grid and was kind of nutty. But he was also from Harvard, and he had a Scullinor across his mantle. So I took a lot of details from that and created a character out of this guy that we had dinner with a couple times.
Yeah. Interesting.
What character.
Yeah. Now you're, wife, Stephanie, wife, mom, has a podcast. Is that right? I kind of stumbled across that when I was looking into your book.
Amongst a few other things.
Yeah.
She's a media personality through and through.
Okay. All right.
Cool. But yeah, she's got a cooking restaurant review pod, a radio show. And then she's got a podcast for cooking. And then she does Makers of Minnesota. That's her podcast, and talks about people that make things in Minnesota.
Local artisans and stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Now let's see. Lee has one fat book with her, and it's called Arctic Dreams. And that book has a great line about stories in it. And I thought that was a really nice tie-in to the fact that there are so many stories shared in this book. But that's not my question. My question is, what fat book would you want to have on a trip like this? Or maybe did you have Ellie?
I think we brought like somewhere like 50 books between all of us.
Did you really?
Oh, an absurd amount. I read 32 on trail. Wow. And some were group books. We read 5 books together as a group out loud at night in the evenings.
What year was
that? 2016 it would have been. Yeah.
I would have brought Arctic Dreams along with me just because there's so many great descriptions of that area and just so much kind of philosophical insight and history. So it kind of covers a lot of things and makes you think. And if you're up there by yourself or with some other people, that's kind of the perfect book. I mean, are you familiar with the book? I mean, it's just a fabulous, it was probably written 20 years ago or so. I think it got a National Book Award, but it's about the Arctic, but it's also about the explorers in the Arctic. It's about the biosystem and the animals of the Arctic. and his journeys to the Arctic. So it's a really, really contemplative book, and it's long. So if you got a 45 days and you don't have TV up there, you want something thick and something that makes you think and something that spurs some conversation. So it's certainly a book I would recommend.
Now, I'm remembering in Cheryl Strayed's book, Wild, she kept sort of burning parts of her book when she read it so she wouldn't have to keep carrying it. Did you?
I have so many issues with
Wild.
Just the survival tactics in that book. I'll say this. Don't ever get rid of your boots because they hurt. Just, oh, my God.
It's a great book, though.
It is. Like, as a book, it's great. As a adventure story, it kind of makes me just grit my teeth and go, that was stupid. But also, my book makes me grit my teeth and go, that was stupid.
Now, Ellie, do you write? I know you took the writing class at UVM. Do you write, too?
Well, I have a bachelor's in English, and I'm like working on writing right now. I do like want to write, and ideally, like ultimately, I want to write books and scripts. But I mean, really, I think I'm working on crafting a story in a lot of ways right now. Still, no amount of classes in college will teach you how to like sit down, put your time in, and figure out how to like craft a story that looks like a full story, for better, for worse. So I guess that's like what I'm trying to do right now, is like develop the hard skills to actually create something that I think is marketable. Because every time I sit down to try to do something creative, it's like, oh, that's good for about a couple pages. And then I ramble for 30. So it's not.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, it's like I write and I'm a writer, I like to say. But you have to develop the hard skills to make it marketable. I mean, this is my dad's, fifth book. It's
the first one.
And the trials.
First one I can get published.
Yeah, the trials and errors of publication. I mean, it is an exhausting process. And it takes a lot of, I think this is what I learned about the publication process through all this. You have to be a self-editor. You have to be critical, or you have to have people in your life who are willing to be critical with your work, and you have to be open to it. Because editors aren't editors anymore to a certain degree. Everyone needs to sell a book, and they're not going to work with you to create a book that's marketable. You kind of have to do that work yourself and figure it out. And you can't just spit something out and say, oh, that's creative, I stand by it. No.
Yeah. Well, and I went to Hampshire College. You familiar with Hampshire College?
Yeah.
You and three other people.
Yeah, no, I've heard of it. I think one of my nephews went to Hampshire College, actually.
That's good. Well, John Krakauer went to Hampshire College, and so did Ken Burns. So we have a few alumni that are famous. But I went there. I studied writing and tried to write for about 3 years afterwards, and lived in L.A. and New York and some other places. And I just didn't have the maturity. You know, it's hard to put down 1,500 words a day. I had to give that up to get a job and move on with my life. But it was nice. I sold a business about 7 years ago and was able to then focus full time on writing. So that was, it was really fun for me to get back to it. And I really enjoy it. And it's been a real blessing for me.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I said this to Ellie. I can't remember if you'd already tuned in, but I'll say it again. So when the publicist first reached out to tell me about your book, I thought it sounded like a good idea for a story, but I really was taken with the idea of the two of you collaborating on it. And sure. I think that's one of the reasons I said yes to the interview. I hate to say that it was because that was sort of cool.
That's
gimmicky,
okay.
Gimmicky. But I was...
You need a hook. You always need a hook.
I was blown away by this book. I really was. I just think it's wonderful. And I think it's great. You've got four more in your drawer. Do you think they're publishable, or having done it so many times, do you feel like the first couple are like, okay, those are my training novels?
I have a couple of training novels, but I wrote a book about, it's more of a thriller book based in Las Vegas in the 80s. And I ran nightclubs in Las Vegas in the 80s. And it's a great book. It's really fun. And my editor should pick it up. He's waiting for to see if I can get some traction on the Barrons. And then hopefully we'll get this one published too.
That's fantastic. All right.
I like that one too. It reads like a Quentin Tarantino movie. It's a little bit faster paced.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask a question about point of view. I'm curious what each of you thinks about the fact that Kurt wrote this from the point of view of a lesbian. And without Ellie's involvement, would he get in trouble for that?
That's a good question.
It's changing. And so I'm just curious, what do you think?
Well, this was something that we had to deal with. I mean, at the end of the day, the book was created all in the same way. And I was proud to lend my experience, lend my voice to what were ultimately authentic characters, not just as young gay women, but as people and holistic people. And I think that, you know, his voice as a writer does not overwhelm their voice as characters or my voice within those characters and my experiences. But at the end of the day, is that marketable without my name on it? And that was, I guess, a challenge that you did kind of face for a time without me trying to get even an editor.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a fact of life that there's going to be a lot of questions about, you know, a 6-year-old white man, straight, writing a book about, you know, 20-some-year-old lesbians. So, we're definitely having to, you know, we definitely had to deal with that. And
well, in this day and age, no one was going to take a risk on.
No, and it's hard to find anybody that would take a risk on it, frankly. So, you know, it kind of gets into that whole cultural misappropriation and writing through other people's eyes that aren't yours. And as a writer, you know, I don't think, you know, as a writer, you have to empathize. You have to have other characters, and those characters have to be diverse. And you can write them three-dimensionally with a certain amount of honesty, or you can use them as caricatures. And when you use them as caricatures, then you are culturally misappropriating those people. And so, and then of course you ride the fine line because you think maybe you're writing them honestly and a person that represents that culture looks at it and says, no, you don't. So it's very subjective. So I think every writer is dealing with that. Mm-hmm. Because nobody, you know, I just can't write a bunch of books about, you know, middle-class white guys growing up in Minnesota. It's just going to be way too boring. And it's not fun. It's just not fun to do.
And by the same thinking, those books are less likely to sell these days. People want to read stories about other people than they've always read, right? So
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Can I share my favorite line with you?
Absolutely.
Please.
This was so great. So there's this scene where Holly and Lee walk into a building where a number of pilots are hanging out, and they really want to find a pilot that's going to take them where they need to go. Anyway, when we walked through the door, the faces of 10 or more pilots, I assumed, looked our way. They stared silently like cows in a pasture. That was so awesome.
Well, thank you.
I mean, it was because the paragraph goes on to say that, you know, obviously they are not seeing two women, that they assume they look like lesbians as they walk in, and that these people haven't seen that lately, I guess. And the cows in a pasture was such a perfect, it was just like wonderful.
You just don't usually see young women in that area, like going paddling like that. It just, you don't see a lot of those people. We got a lot of people who were just fascinated by our presence, right, as like three smaller looking, just young women, all of us. Like, and you know, the pilots, a lot of people find them very amusing. And I find that funny because they were really amusing to me. And we had so many funny interactions. Like when they dropped us off, we thought they were going to drop us off and head out. Right. And then he just posted up and started fly fishing for the next 2 hours while we set up camp and chatted with him.
Well, that, and we spent a lot of time in Nebraska around a lot of cows. So we know what it's like to get looked at by cows in a pasture.
But you know, the look of a cow is a look without a lot of thought. And that was
right.
It was
so
perfect. But it's like, it's dead eyed, but it's still judgmental.
So good. Okay. Let's talk about suspense. I thought, it's funny, you said earlier that this was a very quiet book the first time you wrote it. And I wonder if the suspense ramped up as you went through your drafts. But I thought this had a wonderful kind of, like, just gentle suspense. Not gentle, that's not the right word, but it was not right in your face all the time. I mean, mostly there was this day-to-day experience of Lee getting through her days, and she gets into this bizarre routine where she has to, wherever she's going to camp, she camps during the day to keep Polly's body from disintegrating further, and so she puts her into the cold water, and it almost becomes this bizarre routine that she's used to. But the suspense is there are just these subtle moments, like there's something about swans. I think in the diary about the three men in the barrens who starved, there was some mention of swans that they had seen right before things went bad. And then there's a moment where Holly and Lee see swans, and I'm like, uh-oh. And also when the pressure, the barometric pressure drops, Lee gets migraines. You know, that's a very real threat on a trip like this because you can't function. But on top of it, it just seemed like the barometric pressure was indicating something really important about the weather, but also about the fact she's not going to be able to function if she gets a migraine. And that was a wonderful suspense, too. Anyway, I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about building suspense. I think this is also one of the benefits to having given away the ending up front. It means that the suspense has just more meaning for us. You know, we're not looking to see what's going to happen. We're looking to see how it's going to happen in a way.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, suspense is an interesting thing. So there's kind of two things. So one is, you know, it almost has to be a roller coaster ride. So you have to get the big dips before you have to, you know, slowly rise up on the roller coaster before you have the big dip, and then it's got to go up and down. And so you have to create the energy and suspense around that. It just can't be totally going downhill the whole time. Otherwise it just gets exhausting. And I think, you know, every writer or script writer or cinematographer or anybody kind of knows that sort of thing. The other thing that's weird is that, you know, when I'm writing that swan thing, you know, the swan thing is real in the diary, and the swan thing is real in real life, you know, because Ellie and I were actually paddling up this river in these whistling swans, these Arctic swans.
It's called the Dead River, by the way.
That. So it's real, but subconsciously I'm pulling those two things together and they fall into the book and they make sense and there's some relevancy to it. But how that happened, I don't know. It's not something done consciously. And I'm in a writer's group. And it's so funny when somebody comes to the table with a short story that they're just starting on, and you have this insight into the short story. I'll say, I connect what happened here with what happened here. And did you mean to do that? And nine times out of 10, they say, no, that's not what I meant at all. And then they come back to it, you know, a day later, and they go, oh, my God. I didn't realize that I had that connection, but I didn't even understand that connection. So there's, I tap into my subconscious. I don't have a freaking clue what a lot of it means until it comes out on the page, and then you can develop it a little bit more. But it's fascinating how your subconscious mind makes those connections before you see them on the page at all.
Well, there's another one I was going to ask you about, and I wonder if this is the same thing or a similar thing. I think this was possibly a little bit more intentional, but I want to ask you about it. You have a scene where Holly and Lee are spooning together. It's a very tender scene. They're breathing together. They're holding each other's wrists and feeling their heartbeats, and their heartbeats end up kind of moving into sync together, which is just this incredibly beautiful scene. And then after Holly's fall, Lee is trying to warm her up, and she gets into the sleeping bag and is spooning with her again and is trying to warm her and is trying to get her breath up. And it's clearly a mirror of that earlier, much more happy scene. Okay, so that struck me as maybe something you did on purpose. But then I went back and realized that even before all of that, you had a scene where she's counting the beats between lightning and thunder. And it was like she's like anticipating how far danger is. And it was like that was so beautifully resonant with both of those other scenes, too. And it was all within the same part of the book. Did that, do you know what
not until you brought that up, I didn't even know that that was a connection.
But it really is a nice thought. That's something you actually do. That's a weather tracking technique that I still use because I get scared of storms after being in the woods when they happen.
Yeah, I grew up in Ohio. We always counted the beats between lightning and thunder. Right. Yeah.
But then again, the heartbeat and the counting of that, obviously those two things, you know, they kind of mirror each other in a way. And I didn't even realize that they did until now, but of course they do.
So how do we encourage that as writers? This show is for writers. How do we encourage that as writers? You know, do we just do as much writing as we can because that means that we free up our brains to let the unconscious stuff bubble up?
I think that's true. You know, I know what's really big right now is that one book that came out by George Saunders about writing any
swim in the pond in the rain.
Yeah. And I started reading it. Some people in my writing group are reading it. And I won't read it anymore because if I have to think to that level of detail about what's going on with my characters, I'm going to screw it up. It's just, you can't write that way. You can't write with thinking, okay, this is going to happen and it's going to signify this and it's going to, you can a little bit, but you're going to stifle your writing. So, you know, you really have to, for me at least, I understand how a scene's going to work. You know, you have to visualize that scene before you sit down and write it. And in a lot of cases, my scenes are, let's say, 1,000 to 2,000 words. So I can really just jam it out in a day. But once I get into a paragraph, it's almost pure stream of conscious. And I just let my mind go and see where it goes with the details and what my mind sees. But I don't plan it out in advance. And then, of course, that first draft is gonna suck. And you have to tease out what your subconscious mind was doing or trying to get across because it's that much more, it's just that much smarter than your conscious mind. It really is. So that's what I do. I think it's important as a writer to do the stream of consciousness and then in a later draft, organize it to some extent. But if you can't do the stream of consciousness, you're not going to get to that level of interconnectedness that you're seeing as a reader.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because Ellie, you mentioned before that when you try to write a story, sometimes you just sort of like, I don't remember how you put it, but it sounded like you kind of go down rabbit holes maybe. But maybe that is a really good thing to be doing and you just need to study structure more or something.
Well, I think there is something to be said about just like flexing your muscles and sitting down and writing. And I also think that like people fall into the trap of trying to like tease out meaning or create meaning or plan meaning. And maybe like, and this is what I was talking about. You need to focus on just being able to craft a story. And that's what I keep trying to do is just work through stories, either short or long. I'm just trying to create stories that have structure, that have pacing, that have like something to be some kind of meaning somewhere in them. But that's the thing. It's like when you go back and reread it, you can tease out those meanings. You can find connections that seem natural through the story, through the characters. But if you're like sitting there and aggressively trying to manufacture meaning, then you're going to go back and it's going to sound silly and cringy and inauthentic because it is.
One thing I will say about that George Saunders book, though, is if you listen to it, he reads his sections. He has actors reading the Russian stories, but he's funny and he's smart and you like just let it flow over you and don't worry too much about it. But man, I loved that.
I probably better off listening. I know he has a podcast or some kind of online Substack thing, but I should get more involved with it. Do you ever have writers that bring up the script writing book Story by, I think it's Robert McKee?
I think I have heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of structure, I really love that book. It's about script writing, but it's so important about scene structure because the scene structure in a movie or a play isn't that much different than fiction And I like that structure that he puts out there. So I use that a lot. But, mm-hmm. you know, structure is structure. But once you get into the novel, it's a whole other thing.
I want to ask each of you, what are you reading lately that you would recommend to people who are listening?
I can tell you a book I just finished. It's called The North Water by Ian McGuire. You want to talk about suspense and character. It's a historical fiction about this whaling ship in, you know, the late 1800s when the whaling business is kind of dying out. But man, it's the second time I've read it. And just there's just not a moment when you're not fascinating with the detail and the suspense is over the top. So it's a real good book for me to read just to get my head around, you know, what a real master craftsman is doing. But the book I'm reading now, I actually have it next to me, is this thing, The Method. And it's a nonfiction book about the history of the method in acting. Uh-huh. And so I kind of thought there's got to be, like, how does a character or how does an actor get into the character's head? And what are the methods they go through or the techniques they use through to get into the character's head and become that character? And how can I use that as a writer? So I'm kind of deep into that book and finding it fascinating.
Is that Lee?
Lee Strasberg. The method's based on Lee Strasberg. That's based on something else. But it's written by a guy named Isaac Butler.
What about you, Ellie?
Well, I feel like I haven't. Well, right now I need to sit down and read my dad's next book. But I feel like I want to answer with some of the books that I read while I was on trail, actually.
Oh, wow.
Like three books that come to mind. The first one is just funny. It was a Julia Quinn book of the Bridgerton series. We read it aloud on trail. It was very scandalous and very fun. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Hyacinth Bridgerton's book. The name of her book, I cannot remember, but I hope it's going to be adapted at some point in the future. The other two books that we read, they're both kind of magical realism, Spanish language originally. Isabel Allende, The House of the Spirits is one I read, and I reread that on trail, actually. It's one of my favorites. And it's a longer book, and I think a really good one to read when you're feeling existential and thinking about life and everything. And we also read as a group book, and this is one that we all adored, and it's the first in a series, Shadow of the Wind.
Oh, yeah.
By, God. Carlos Ruiz Zafón.
Yeah.
Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, I'm pretty sure the name is. But I adore that book. And I like reading either grand adventure stories or these kind of like, you know, really existential books on trail, like really make you think about your place in the world and in society and blah, 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 blah. Like kind of when you're outside of society, it's fun to contemplate like how we all as people participate within it and what we are outside of it.
Great. Wonderful. Those are wonderful. Okay. So my last question is always a question of advice for writers. And in your case, I thought I would ask about endings. So in The Barrens, we feel like we get the ending up front, as we've talked about. And then actually there's another point where we kind of feel like we've come to an ending.
Right.
Which I won't give away, but then it unfolds further, and there are more characters, there are more things that happen, and I kind of loved that because there was so much pressure on that first incident to have a lot of unfolding of ending at the end felt appropriate. So anyway, I wonder if you can just each of you talk about what you find to be a satisfying ending in a book.
It's a good question. I mean, for this, when I look at endings. I look at you know, the character has to go through an emotional arc. And to me, you know, I synthesize it down to the ending for the main character is either kind of losing family or finding family. And sometimes family means different things. You know, family can be a group of people. It could actually be a real family. And, you know, leaving family is a lot of times, losing family is a lot of times a coming of age story. So she had to come off that river. She had kind of come of age. She had lost her family, you know, because her father was in prison and she didn't have anything to go back to in Nebraska. So I wanted her to find family. I wanted her to move on with her life. And so that's what the ending is about finding family. But I also didn't want to shy away from that confrontation between Lee, the main character, and Holly's parents, and talking to them, because it was scary to write about and daunting. But I felt like I needed to really plunge in to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks.
I feel like that in a lot of way kind of answers what my, well, kind of says what my answer is going to be. I believe that, like, in a lot of ways, the endings that are most satisfying to me, the most cathartic to me, maybe so, is the ones that are cyclical, that, like, do not shy away from making sure that they, like, understand where the characters were at the beginning of this journey, and maybe, like, maybe not shying away from not over-explaining the change, like, with the ending of the story. Don't over-explain, like, what's different from the beginning. Almost, like, over-explain why the beginning feels the same, but we're here now so different after having gone on this journey. That feels like a little wordy, but I feel like, yeah, I require some kind of, like, a cyclical understanding of the beginning in order to feel satisfied with the end. Mm-hmm. I don't like cliffhangers. I don't like when books just kind of end or, like, leave you with some kind of, like, vague, you decide the meaning. I'm like, I already decided the meaning. To me, you were supposed to end the book.
Well, I like a little bit of an open-ended ending, because this book does have an open-ended ending. You kind of wonder what she's going to do next. I mean, it implies it, but it doesn't spell it out. But yeah, and any, you know, that, like Ellie said, the character needs to learn something, and you have to understand on at least on some level what that character learned.
Yeah, I think it was Sam Shepard who said that the best endings actually offer new beginnings as well. And I thought
absolutely,
that was a kind of nice way of putting that.
Absolutely.
All right, I want to mention again, the name of your novel is The Barrens, a novel of love and death in the Canadian Arctic, by Kurt and Ellie Johnson, and published by Arcade. Thank you both so much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you for having us. It's been really fun.
Thank you very much.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Ellie and Kurt Johnson. You can learn more about their book, The Barrens, at kurtjohnsonbooks.com. This week I have two Write the Book prompts to offer, thanks to the generosity of my guests. Kurt Johnson suggests writing a paragraph with a beginning and end that you know ahead of time, but allow the middle to be more stream of consciousness. Ellie suggests trying to write an adventure. Pick an area of the world where a character is camping, and write about what goes wrong. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I'm a little short on time for the Bookworm's calendar this week, but I will mention that there's going to be a new book festival in Burlington this year. The Green Mountain Book Festival will host its first annual weekend-long event September 23rd through the 25th, 2022, with support from Phoenix Books and the Fletcher Free Library, and featuring former Write the Book guest, Ruth Ozeki, and numerous other authors. So that's pretty exciting. I would love your feedback about Write the Book. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are also available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with people who might enjoy. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.